Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be looking at Africa and the New World Order. I am joined by a very special guest, Dr. Daniel Vollmann. Daniel is the director of the African Security Research Project based in Washington, D.C., and he's a specialist on U.S. military policy towards Africa and African security issue with over five decades of experience researching, writing, and speaking on these issues. Daniel, it's a very privilege to have you join us today, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation with you.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Okay, let's start off. So from the 18th century, or even earlier than that, maybe from the 16th century, if we trace the history of development, Africa's always played some kind of significant position to the world in terms, to the world. We look at it during the second colonial time, had a lengthy period of colonialism. And now we're beginning to see, then we had the Cold War. So it looks like we're beginning to see a new world order that is kind of emerging. And Africa is once again becoming significant to that geopolitical kind of like competition. So how is the continent actively reshaping international political and economic dynamics in that sense?
Well, I think in two major ways. One is that it's always been an arena for external powers. During the Cold War, it was particularly the United States and the Soviet Union. More recently, it's been a whole host of external actors: the Russian Federation, China, Turkey, Iran, the United Arab Emirates, a whole host of external actors using Africa as an arena for proxy wars with each other and in pursuit of what they perceive to be their own political, military, and economic interests, usually at the expense of African people. I think the other major factor is Africa's role in the global economy. Until fairly recently, that was chiefly focused on Africa's oil and natural gas production and exports. It's recently become even more, Africa's become even more important to the global economy because it produces and exports a significant, if not overwhelming, proportion of the minerals which are required for advanced modern technology, cell phones, computers, electronic infrastructure, and devices. And it's only become more important over time. That's an argument I've always made. It's important now. It's only going to become more important in the future.
Okay. Having said that, we've seen, you mentioned the host. So during the Cold War, we saw two major actors, the United States and the Soviet, former Soviet Union. But now, like you rightly mentioned, we're seeing a diversification of actors, what we call the middle powers. You mentioned them: UAE, Iran, Turkey, and all of that. How does this compare to the Cold War, to the geopolitical competition during the Cold War?
Well, in the Cold War, the United States preferred to rely on its European allies to deal with the conflict with the Soviet Union and with communism as a global threat, without the United States becoming directly involved, the United States could focus its attention on Latin America, Indochina, other parts of the world, which is why for many, many years, the United States administered its military policy towards Africa through European command, through its relationships with European powers, which it counted upon to use their military forces and their influence and power to serve our interests so we didn't have to. After the beginning of the millennium, the United States concluded that it had to become much more directly involved. It couldn't no longer rely upon its European allies, particularly France, to do all the heavy lifting for it, to intervene in what was that, Zaire, and a host of other crises over the years. And that's why the AFRICOM was created, for the first time, a separate U.S. military command to administer U.S. military policy towards Africa.
But speaking of France, so what we've seen is that the U.S. for the longer period of time relied on France. But we've seen in recent years a strong anti-France sentiment, not just in the Sahel. We've seen across, other African states where France have been booted out of those places. And the U.S. as well, in Niger, in Chad, they've lost some of the bases they have there. What implication does that have on Western influence?
That was a real shock for Washington. It developed a drone base in Niger and became deeply involved in military training and arms sales to countries all across the Sahel in the hopes that it could head all of this off using primarily military instruments without devoting much attention to democracy, to responsible governments, to economic development, could handle it all through African command, treated as a military problem. And that clearly failed for a whole host of reasons. And as you say, not only did were the French the traditional power in the Sahel and West Africa unceremoniously expelled, but so were the Americans out of the drone base in Niger. They're trying to sort of regroup in countries in coastal West Africa, in the Ivory Coast, in Benin, in Ghana, and other countries, where they hoped to sort of set up to retreat. I mean, that's the word I use. They retreated back to these coastal countries in the hope that they can hold the line there against these spreading jihadi armed groups and the violence in Mali, in Niger, in Burkina Faso, and now in other countries in those regions. But violence is increasing now in those countries. There was just a major clash in Benin between the army and armed jihadists in that country. So, and the U.S. is only in the process of figuring out how it's going to retreat and how it's going to operate in those countries. And those countries are now deciding to what extent they want to cooperate with the United States militarily. Is that a sensible thing for them to do, having seen what happened in the Sahel? And then what do they want to allow the United States to do? Because they have leverage too. The United States has to get them to agree.
Yeah, I'll come to that in a minute. I'll come to the leverage, to the levers of power that this state have as well on the United States and other external kind of partners. Yeah. But I wanted to stay on, how do you compare? So there's recently in the Congress, one of the congressmen, I forgot, I think it was Peter Kay or something from either Pennsylvania or something, has come out to say that USAID was sponsoring jihadist movements in Africa, including Boko Haram, ISIS, and all of that. And this is the development side of things, not just the military side of things. Well, do you have an opinion on that?
I'm sorry, are you asking, do I agree that the United States is is at least in part responsible for creating these groups. And for
but I think what the congressman is saying.
Is that what you're asking?
So I'm saying, does the development intervention as well? We kind of like focus on the military intervention or this military bases, but is the development aspect as well, AIDS and all of that, do they not have same, if not more, adverse impact in escalation of, or directly and indirectly sponsoring prolonging conflicts, or even funding terrorism?
You mean funding and supporting the jihadis?
Yeah, that is what I get from war.
I've heard that argument made. I've never seen any evidence to support those assertions. I think the United States, the problem with the United States is not that it's supporting the jihadis, but that it's relying almost exclusively on military and security involvement to counter them. It's not taking the necessary steps to promote democracy and economic development and responsible governments that are democratically elected, that are held responsible to their own citizens. If the United States did more of that more effectively, more successfully, it does do some, I'll give it some credit under some administrations, but that's, if those countries are going to deal with the problem of armed jihadi violence, that's the way it's going to be held, going to be dealt with. It's not going to be solved by military means.
By the local
African militaries or by anybody else. I mean, the Russians can't handle it. The Chinese, I think, are smart enough not even to try. I think they understand how futile American military involvement has been, and they're not eager to imitate that.
We'll come back to the Chinese and the Russia in a minute.
Yeah, these things are all connected.
Yeah, they're very, very connected. But I wanted to talk about what you mentioned earlier about the littoral states, Ghana, and how they are learning from what happened in the Sahel, and looking at how they are looking at how they want to deal with the United States and NATO and other Western countries. So I think Ivory Coast recently joined in denouncing or sending out the French from the state. So now what I want to link that to the leverage that African countries have as well. And looking at during the Cold War, where they were able to manipulate, because sometimes we look at them as not having power, but it looked like they were able to manipulate the competition between the Soviet Union and the United States. So in this current climate, with this geopolitics, how is Africa exercising that levers of power in terms of the competition?
Yeah, the dynamic has changed. It's been very interesting how the dynamic has changed. During the Cold War, African countries could, to a certain limited extent, play off the East versus the West, the U.S. versus the Soviet Union, the French versus the Americans. They could, to a certain extent, manipulate the external actors, but they were under enormous pressure and enormous threat if they tried to do that in ways that displeased the external actors. If the United States or the French or the Russians wanted to overthrow governments, they didn't hesitate to do that. They sent their troops in, and they overthrew regimes that they wanted to overthrow. That's not possible anymore. I mean, that's pretty clear in the case of the French. 20 years ago, the stuff in the Sahel, they would have sent the French troops in, and they would have overthrown all the hunters. I mean, just like they used to do in Zaire and a number of other cases in the past, they can't do that anymore for a whole variety of reasons. So the African countries are not under the threat that you have to choose one side or the other. They can, in fact, choose all of them at the same time and to a certain extent, play them off against each other. They can go to the Chinese for certain things. They can go to the Russians for certain things. They can go to the Emiratis for certain things. And they can still maintain a relationship with the United States and the French and the British and get certain things out of them. Because they can always say to them, if you don't make a deal with us, we'll make a deal with somebody else. There's a whole host of competitors out there.
Speaking of that, we've seen, do you agree that there's, I believe, I don't know if you agree, that there is a battle, there's a new world order is shaping up. And we see expansion in the BRICS, we see expansion of NATO, we see what's going on in Ukraine and all of that, we see all of this. Do you think that's what's happening? Is there like a move or contest for a new world order? Because there seems to be an agreement that we definitely need a new world order. And America's hegemony has been seriously threatened. That is, if there's a singular hegemony that we have now.
Right. No, I think you're absolutely correct. There was what one might call a bipolar world order in the Cold War. You could sort of divide the world, and then there was the non-aligned countries, or the South, or however, the Third World, various descriptions of countries trying to find a way not to be caught between the two giants. The world is now, the dynamic has become much, much more complicated. And that's, as you say, that's true everywhere in the world, these new economic forces. And I think it's fair to say, or I certainly would argue, the U.S. is no longer a hegemonic power, and that China and Russia, to a certain extent, although it's not entirely complete in their minds, I think, yet, aspire to be global hegemons. I don't think Russia has the capability of doing that for a whole host of reasons. The Chinese are in a position to at least aspire to that position. They have the economic development, they have the military power, they have the government structure to act as the United States used to act, aspire and to seek to be, to act like a global hegemon. But I don't think in the end they alone can do that. That's one of the reasons they're members of the BRICS group. That's one of the reasons they've aligned themselves with the Putin regime in Russia, is that they know they have a much better chance of becoming hegemonic if they have allies. That's a lesson that the United States learned in World War II and practiced itself. That's why it established NATO, because it didn't want to have to rely purely on its own resources. It needed allies. It went out and developed and created them. Same thing is happening in the growing conflict and tensions between the U.S. and China, is that both China and the United States are building alliances and coalitions with other powers and other countries in the region, the Japanese, the South Koreans. The Chinese just made a deal with, what was it, the Cook Islands, these small island states. They're assembling coalitions because they're stronger when they work, when they have subordinates supporting them. And the problem is that they're all doing that simultaneously. And that tends to lead to massive wars, World War I, World War II. It's also very, very difficult to establish a stable hegemony when you can't really get your allies to agree with you. And the Chinese in particular have a lot of problems with that, because the BRICS group, which has now been enlarged, so it's what, 14 members, they all have different agendas. They don't all just sign on to the Chinese agenda. They don't all just sign on to the Russian agenda. They are trying to find ways to work together to achieve things that they want for themselves. And that causes conflicts within the group and makes it difficult for it to have the kind of influence and power in the world that it would if they all signed on the dotted line to what the Chinese want. So I would describe the current world as a not a multi-hegemonic world, but a non-hegemonic world. Nobody's in charge. The UN isn't in charge, the Americans aren't in charge, and the Chinese aren't in charge. And it's not, as far as I can tell, it's not going to be easy for any of them to reassert their hegemony or to establish their own hegemony. The Americans aren't going to be hegemonic, the Chinese aren't going to get what they want. It's going to be crisis and chaos and a lot of violence, a lot of war. And that's what we're seeing in Africa, because it's always been treated as a convenient arena for those countries to fight their wars and let other people, Africans, die for them.
And that's what I'm saying. And that's what some scholars are saying, that there is no leadership. So one of the, in the literature, and I think you must have also contributed to that as well, where you look at some people argue in the literature and say it's good to have a hegemon, because then you have a centralized system where you can intervene. Like, look what's going on in Sudan. Look what's going on in Congo. But in the absence of a hegemon, you know, we tend to have all of this humanitarian crisis. So do you think not having all this hegemon is dangerous? We're like in a very dangerous place in the world.
Yeah, it is. And I think it also, not only is it very dangerous, because as I said, I don't think any of them is in a position to really impose its interests on the world, but the obvious alternative is a world government, is the, what the UN was supposed to be, which is everybody compromising and working together so that these things didn't happen. And the UN, of course, has never really been able to fulfill that aspiration. It's made some incredible, it's done some incredible good work, but it's never really been able to create an hegemony that wasn't controlled by one of its member states. That's how the permanent five system with the veto in the Security Council was set up. So that it was set up, of course, when the Soviet Union was the only non-Western country, because the Chinese seat was held by the nationalist Chinese, who are now on Taiwan, not by the People's Republic. So it was four against one. And the members of the General Assembly were almost all pro-Western at that time. There were very few exceptions at that time. So the U.S. just assumed that it could run everything through the U.N. And it sort of, you know, sort of worked in Korea, because the Soviet Union wasn't at the meeting where they voted to support the war in Korea. But that's never happened before, because the Chinese and the Russians have never made that mistake again. So it's to cite an example, for the example you just cited, in Sudan, there was a resolution which didn't explicitly call for, but at least allowed for the possibility of the international community intervening to prevent further humanitarian disasters, to get food to people who were starving, to get medicine to people who were suffering, and to stop the war. And the Russians vetoed it, because that's the way they set up the Security Council. It can't do anything, because somebody will always veto it. The only exception, of course, was the Security Council vote to authorize intervention
in Libya. Libya.
In 2011, where both Russia and China could have vetoed it, and they chose not to. They chose to allow it to go forward. They didn't vote for it. They abstained. But they allowed it to go forward. And for them to say that it was an American or a NATO operation and that they were tricked into allowing it to go forward is ludicrous. They knew perfectly well what was going to happen. They knew it was a vote for regime change that would lead to the overthrow of Gaddafi, and it would lead to the present chaos in Libya. And they did not veto it. They have nothing. All their complaints about what happened to Libya were because they didn't veto it.
Speaking of this intervention, but we'll come back to it. Speaking of the P5, so what we've seen in recent times is Africa calling for a change in the P5 setup. And Africa is calling for being part of that membership. What do you think of that? What do you make of that?
Well, Africa, if you look at the history, Africa has always had a lot of members on the Security Council. They weren't permanent. They were rotating. They kept shifting from country to country, which, among other things, allowed a lot of African countries to speak and represent themselves and speak at the Security Council. Now, you could mandate that more of them were given seats. You could give them permanent seats. You could get, you could allocate seats to the AU. Those would give Africa representation. Those would not give Africa power, because power rests in the hands of the permanent five who have the veto, and they decide everything. It really doesn't. The other people can get up and make speeches, and it's important that they do that, that they express the opinions of people outside of the permanent five, but the permanent five make the decisions. And until that changes, the balance of power can't change. And none of those countries will ever discuss giving up the veto or giving the veto to anybody else. I mean, discuss that further, but that's my opinion, is that it's never going to change.
But then again, does that mean, you know, because we're looking at, you mentioned the UN, definitely after 80 years, the UN seems to be, definitely knows the UN is a troubled institution. The UN cannot handle the problems we have in this modern time.
Well, it's not allowed to handle it by its members. That's the way it was set up, so that the permanent five could stop anything they didn't want. That's what they do.
The US but then again, when we see
the Russians did it when it came to Sudan, where they just got a military base.
But then we look at so if I bring it back to what's going on, you were talking about the kind of competition or the disharmony, not necessarily, but the different interests, divergent interests among the BRICS. But even in NATO, with Trump coming, we see some crack in NATO as well. We see crack, and we see with Trump coming in and the challenge against multilateral organizations like the ICC and WHO. So it just seems like we're not reaching any positive light. We're not reaching light at the tunnel. We are receding backwards.
What we've been talking about has been state to state and international community politics. And that's not where the answers are going to come from, and that's not where the solution is going to come from. The solution is going to come from the people. It's going to come from people organizing social movements, like they did in Sudan to overthrow the Bashir regime. And I mean, people in Africa have fought for decades, for centuries, for their freedom and for democracy and legitimate governments, and you know, for jobs and for education and for healthcare. They have fought year after year after year. They've suffered enormously at the hands of their own elite governments, incredible levels of violence, countries like Nigeria and elsewhere, directed against civil society, against people demanding to be treated fairly. But they're the ones who are going to change things in the end, because that's what the history of the world teaches you. America didn't abolish slavery out of the goodness of its heart. It abolished slavery because we had a civil war, and hundreds of thousands of people died. And there was mass movements demanding the abolition of slavery. We didn't get women's rights out of the goodness of anybody's heart. Blacks didn't get their vote in this country out of the goodness of anybody's heart. They fought for it, and they suffered for it, and they struggled for it, and they won. You can win. And
I agree with you 100%.
That's the future. That's my
hope. I agree with you 100%. This reminds me of Frantz Fanon. And Frantz Fanon's kind of like a principle. Yes. But speaking of the African people, I think already we can see, I don't know if you agree with me, we can already see some of those changes. We saw in Kenya the last time, we saw youth coming onto the street to protest against the anti-attacks. We saw we could also see the whole of Sahel, although it's been manipulated by the military regime and Russia. But we saw the people coming out and you know, tired. We saw in Nigeria, like you mentioned, the ENSAS protests fighting against, was seen in South Africa, where liberation parties are losing now in Botswana, in Mozambique, in South. Do you think that revolution, sort of people revolution, is already happening in a way?
Well, I mean, what history is the back and forth struggle of people trying to make the world a better place. And that's why we've made whatever progress we've made in the last 5-10,000 years, why we mostly have gotten rid of slavery, although there's some exceptions in certain parts of the world, and why a lot of things have gotten better for a lot of people. But there's nothing inevitable about it. You have to fight for it. And I think the people in Africa are an example to the world of what you can achieve if you fight for it. South Africa is an important example, particularly because I think the anti-apartheid movement in the United States played an important role in helping end apartheid by forcing the U.S. government to enact sanctions against the South African apartheid regime so that to convince the apartheid regime that they couldn't hold on to power. Because Americans would no longer, because America, they would suffer sanctions in the United States, and those sanctions were the accomplishment of the American people and important people in Congress who got together, and they passed it over Ronald Reagan's veto. They 1984 they passed the Anti-Apartheid Act to impose sanctions on South Africa. Ronald Reagan was president. He vetoed it, and they overturned his veto. And the South Africans at that point could see that not only were they facing the ANC and other groups in South Africa and all of Africa, but they were also now going to have to deal with the American people who were tired of watching apartheid go on year after year.
You seem to have a benign assessment of the Chinese strategy in Africa. Yeah. And I say this, because I know the Chinese have this non-interference kind of policy. But I think their strategy as well in the long term could be detrimental in terms of economic imperialism and the debt that Africans are indebted to them, and that debt will pass on to the youth of the African people, and that could be another form of long-term imperialism. I don't know what you see about our strategy. I don't know whether I want to reassess Chinese strategy.
Yeah, I think it's a very mixed record on both sides. I don't think the Chinese have gotten a lot of the things they expected to get out of Africa in return for all the money they put in, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where they invested $10 billion. They outbid the World Bank and the IMF to get control of the mining industry in the Congo. So they now run a lot of the mines in the Congo, and obviously they import a lot of the minerals produced out of the Congo, but they haven't gotten anywhere near what they expected to get for all that money. And they realize at this point they're never going to get most of it back. And African countries have received some beneficial investments. Some of the infrastructure projects the Chinese have invested in and used their companies and their workers to build have been useful and have promoted some development. A lot of them haven't. And the Chinese have really pulled back from their Belt and Road Initiative projects in Africa. They could see that they're putting a lot of money into countries in return for things they're never going to get. And so they abandoned a lot of the projects that they announced they were going to fund. And the Chinese government has instructed its own financial institutions to pull back on investments in Africa, to be much more cautious and much more practical, to be much more the way Donald Trump sees the world. You know, what's in it for us? What guarantees do we have that we're going to get paid back in the things that we want to be paid back in? The deal with the Democratic Republic of Congo was supposed to dramatically expand mineral production in the DRC and ensure that it all went to China. And a lot of that hasn't happened because, of course, the DRC has been engulfed in violence and warfare.
I agree with you. In my study, in my recent study, I've been looking at, I've not used particularly used this term, but now I'm thinking about it from what you said about Trump's, what we're going to get. So now I'm thinking, maybe we should, maybe Africans should use a transaction approach, because it is, I believe there's no altruistic intervention. Every intervention has strategic interest. Every intervention has a strategic interest. So it's all about transparency. This is what we want. And Africans can say, okay, this is what we want. And then that way there could be a win-win situation. I don't know if you're, because I think with the West, what's happened in the past is they come under the cloak, or the Western in the past, IMF, World Bank, they come under the cloak of, you know, development, but that is not the recourse, and Africans are tired of that, and that is why they kind of prefer the Chinese approach. They can see the infrastructure, they can see the bridges, they can see the roads, but not necessarily favorable to them in terms of the Chinese are taking all these minerals. So do you think Africa should change its strategy and have a kind of like win-win situation and say, this is what we want, this is what you want, you know, you want these minerals, we have these minerals, this is what we want, can we see that and be transparent about it? Do you think that's the way forward?
Right, well, I think the fact of the matter is that they're way ahead of everybody else on that, on doing that. They saw that was starting to happen, and they started doing whatever they could to take advantage of it, to play different external actors off against each other, to bargain with other people. And they're way ahead of, Donald Trump has been doing this for decades too. And in a way, the Bridge and Road Initiative was always a transactional program. And that's been going on now for what, 10, 15 years. So the Africans have been dealing with this, with that, and trying to take advantage of it. I mean, I'm talking about African political and economic elites, because they're the ones who are entering into these relationships. They've been doing that for years. And, you know, a lot of these people are intelligent, and they know how the world works, and they do what they can to take advantage of this new global dynamic, this non-polar dynamic where they have lots of choices, but they have limited leverage themselves. It doesn't always work out so well. For example, in the Sahel, I can understand why the hunters are doing what they're doing. I think it's incredibly greedy and selfish and self-interested. And I think it's already clear that it's failed, because they essentially hired what was then the Wagner Group, the Russian mercenaries.
Yeah, Africa Corp now.
Who have now been replaced or recreated as the Africa Corps, which is directly controlled by Putin, and it's essentially a regime, what's called a regime protection force. They're not really there to stabilize the countries. They're there to keep the leaders alive and to plunder everything they can get their hands on, because that's the way the Russians, like everybody else, like the Chinese and the Americans, that's the deal they make. I mean, that's what Trump is talking about with all these countries, too. So it's already clear in the Ukraine. I think he's going to do the same thing with the DR Congo. Is it will help the DR Congo government if they essentially give all their minerals to us.
To us.
What they said to the Ukrainians. They said, we'll abandon you unless you hand over all of your minerals.
All this missed out, too.
In fact, it's now been revealed they're even asking for more economic assets in the Ukraine than just the minerals. So everybody is engaged. I mean, that's the new global order in a way. It has nothing to do with ideology. It doesn't even really have anything to do with economic development. It's elites in various countries in Africa and outside of Africa lining their own pockets, getting money for themselves. All their decisions are based on what's in it for me, not what's in it for my country, but what's in it for me. And that's clearly the way Trump looks at everything.
Yeah, I agree with you.
A company that he runs.
I agree with you 100%. It's and that's what's happening in even in DRC. We see with the government of Kagame in Rwanda. This authoritarian government are being emboldened. We see what's going on across all of these places. It's just greed. It's just pure greed. There's nothing ideological or humanitarian or human rights or democracy. It's not going to do with that. But another thing I'm seeing is Africans as well are beginning to play some sort of interventionist role. So we've seen it in the 80s or in the 90s where you see with ECOMOG intervening in the civil war in Sierra Leone, in Liberia. But now we're seeing Africans for the first time. We saw in Haiti where the Kenyan-led multilateral police in there, and then we see the African standby force. We're seeing all of what do you think? Do you think Africa is projecting itself in a way where it might be able to handle its own internal crisis without needing the Security Council to sanction any kind of intervention?
Well, I think they have the capability. I mean, the best example of that was the Nigerian intervention in Liberia, which didn't exactly go quite the way everybody wanted it to go, but ultimately left behind this relatively stable, relatively democratic government because of what was primarily Nigerian military intervention. It's not impossible to do that. I think it's very tricky. You should be very careful about that, about relying on military intervention to solve economic and political and social problems. The obstacle, and not just in Africa, is getting all the different countries to agree on the same thing. I mean, the Democratic Republic of Congo, you have Rwanda, you have Burundi, very deeply involved.
Against Uganda. Burundi.
You have Uganda involved, sort of with Rwanda, sort of independently. You have the South Africans, who have a very strong force, a lot of soldiers, but very heavily equipped, who could play a much larger military role, but the South African government isn't quite sure what it wants to achieve. And what price it's willing to pay, because they've already taken heavy casualties, and there's a lot of public concern and outrage at devoting all these, at putting all these young men, primarily young men, and all this money in jeopardy without any clear objective.
Okay, if we come to the last question, let's kind of like winding down, and let's look at Africa's strategic position, one with his vast natural resources, and then we could also talk about his burgeoning youth demographic, you know, and then we see this youth demographic becoming more politically conscious and, you know, more demanding of change, and then again we see again Africa becoming also important in global geopolitical realignment, you know, joining some of the blocs, realignment, playing all of that. How do you assess the continent's long-term trajectory? Like, what do you think, you know, is going to be, what's going to drive its evolution as a central player in shaping, one, the continental future and also the global future order?
Right. Well, I think in the short term, I'm afraid that what we're seeing now is what we're going to continue to see for years. We're going to see completely irresponsible international community. We're going to see the Russians and the Chinese and the Americans and a host of other countries taking advantage of these conflicts and these problems for their own advantage, to make money for themselves, to gain power, influence, and prestige. I mean, I pray that's, and we're going to see African elites collaborating with that and opposing efforts by their own citizens to create a Pan-African force. I mean, and Pan-Africanism, you know, is a big part of the answer. If the African people are working together and not just being oppressed by their elites who are plundering them and killing them just like the external actors are, then things will change. And I think that's true in other parts of the world. But I think, I'm afraid we're a long ways away from that, and it's going to be a long, hard fight to get there. I just hope, I believe and hope we will get there.
I share your hope as well, but I agree with you. In the short term or medium term, it does look bleak. It does look very, 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 very bleak. But, well, thank you very much, Dr. Volman. It's been, you know, an interesting conversation that I've had with you this evening. I know it's about around midday where you are now, but
I mean, these are serious subjects. I was not trying to be frivolous about them because they really do matter. Yeah. Millions of people's lives are at stake right now in places like Sudan, and nobody is going to stop that. It's just going to keep going on.
We've recently done an episode on Sudan, looking at the neglected one, the high humanitarian crisis. We've done an episode on the M23 and Congo, and you know the sheer brazen humanitarian killings, and you know with no repercussion. You know, it's just unbelievable and it's unfortunate. But you know, we do hope we can. You know, there can be some glimmer of hope for these people and these places. But thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Go on.
Hope is that people keep fighting to stop this.
I agree with you. But yeah, we do. I do appreciate your rich insight into this, and we appreciate you honoring that invitation. And but anyways, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed talking to you. I hope what I said was useful.
It was very useful. Very useful. Very useful. Have a great day, sir.
Okay, you too.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you once again for tuning in to another wonderful section. And as usual, I invite you to join me to thank our guest, a very renowned researcher, activist, scholar, Dr. Daniel Volman, that has been doing this for the last 50 years, and you know, joining, expressing the hope that we would see a better world, prosperous world, and more secured world. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.